we please have a roll call?
I'd like to do the Pledge of Allegiance first.
All right, we can do the Pledge of Allegiance first or second. Actually, I'd like to do a roll call first to make sure we have a quorum. I think we do.
We have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Okay, so we're not going to do a roll call?
If that's your call.
Yes, please. Do a roll call.
Start left to right.
Are you going to call us or are we just volunteer?
Just state your name, I suppose.
State your name.
Michael Collins, present.
Cynthia Delaney, present.
Doug Delvine, present.
Tim Jones.
Bob Beers.
John Mars.
Mary Beth Scow.
Ken Osgood.
Stan Smith.
Anita Wood.
Quorum?
Yes.
Quorum, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Chair Woodbury is not with us today, so I'm your stunt chair. We have recognitions this morning?
There are no recognitions this morning.
Okay, then at this time we will open the microphone for public comment, a period devoted to comments by the general public about those items appearing on the agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes per speaker. Please step up to the speaker's podium, clearly state your name and address. Spell your last name for the record. If any member of the board wishes to extend the length of a presentation, this can be done by myself or by the board by majority vote. Does anyone have something to say? Good morning.
Hi, my name is Jill Perlstein, P-E-R-L-S-T-E-I-N, 2420 Black River Falls Drive, Henderson, Nevada. I am a community health nurse in the Southern Nevada Health District in the Maternal Child Health Program. I just want to thank you for your continued support that you gave us last year in March to continue our program. In August, I'll just update you what's been going on. In August, we started our outcome data collection, which is what you were looking for, to gather outcomes to see how our program was working. Information that was gathered from this program in the WebIZ documentation before August was not gathered by us, and it was gathered without any request by us. At this time, our team is now one nurse and a half nurse. One nurse went to CPS as their CPS liaison. One nurse is going to the Healthy Start program. Myself, I am their only full-time nurse, and I will be going to the NFP program at the end of March. Madeline Sparks will be covering the maternal child health desk. She also does covers lead, and she helps with refugee and other programs. She is also will be the only single child care health consultant functioning in the district. I am moving to the NFP program, and it will allow me to continue working with maternal child children, mothers and children, in an evidence-based program, and it'll also help continue access and need. Lorraine is going to Healthy Start, which is also doing that in a different, in a totally different program, but also evidence-based. But we also want to thank you for your continued support. It really meant a lot to us last year when we did get funded for this year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any additional public comment? If you'll please mark Commissioner Giunculiani and Dr. Nemec present. Agenda item 2 is the adoption of the February 26, 2015 agenda. Does anyone have any proposed changes to the agenda? We have a motion for approval of the agenda.
Second.
And a second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Item 3 is the consent agenda. Is there a motion?
Move to accept.
Second.
Motion to approve and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
With one abstention, since I was not here for the minutes, but I will accept the petition.
Okay. Motion passes. Agenda item 4, public hearing and possible action. Members of the public are allowed to speak on public hearing action items after the board's discussion and prior to our vote. Each speaker will be given 5 minutes to address the board on any pending topic. No person may yield his or her time to any other person. In those situations where large groups of people desire to address the board on the same matter, we would request that you select only one or two speakers from your group to address the board on behalf of your group. Once the public hearing is closed, no additional public comment will be accepted. Item 4 sub 1 is Memorandum 3-15. Consider or adopt amendments to the district's trauma system regulations, Southern Nevada Trauma System Plan, and Trauma System Performance Improvement Plan. Direct staff accordingly or take other actions deemed necessary. Hi, please state your name.
Good morning. My name is Mary Ellen Britt. I'm a manager of the Office of Emergency Medical Services and Trauma System here at the Howe District.
Is the mic not working? Please record Councilwoman Leavitt as present.
Thank you, Leo.
Now we're good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Today I am here to present the trauma system regulations, the trauma system plan, and the trauma system performance improvement plan for your consideration and adoption. Mr. Chairman, would you prefer that I go through each document individually, or would you like me to go through all three documents and then pause for questions at that point?
Does the board have any preference?
Probably all three, and then we can ask questions.
And it would seem just as an overview would be adequate for our purposes as opposed to a line detail.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll begin with the trauma system regulations. The trauma system regulations were last reviewed and revised in April of 2012. Throughout this document, there were housekeeping changes to update language. And I would just draw your attention to one major change in the document, and that is in section 300.700, where we redefined the appeal process. Upon review of the previous process, it was identified that it would be more appropriate that if there were an appeal to a decision made by the board to deny an applicant for authorization as a trauma center, that it would be more appropriate for that to go through the district court system rather than through our hearing officer process. And so that is on page 14 of the trauma system regulations, and the new language there defines how that process would work. Beyond that, there were not any other significant changes, with the exception of on page, that's in the trauma system plan. Let me stop there. So there weren't any other changes to the regulations that were significant other than the housekeeping changes.
How often do you have an appeal?
We have not had one for this purpose. You know, for the trauma system, there has not been an appeal to date.
Thank you.
Next is the trauma system plan. And this document was originally written in 2005 and adopted by the board in February of 2006. Again, throughout this document, there were many housekeeping changes. We needed to update the language to reflect the current status of the system because we have matured since the system was first formed in 2005. Prior to that, we had one trauma center, and with the addition of two trauma centers, there was truly a need to develop a more comprehensive system. And so this plan has undergone a fair amount of revision. We've updated language and again provided additional detail about what a trauma system is. We hope that this document will be a reference for the public and policymakers to understand what is a trauma system and what the components of our trauma system are. In the executive summary, that's where most of those changes took place. I would then draw your attention to the compliance with state statutes and regulations section on page 15. Mr. Jones identified that in our description of the board that the language we currently have, which indicates a representative of a non-gaming business or industry representative who is subject to regulation by the board. That language is not exactly as it's written in the bylaws, and so he has requested that we make that change and sync that up with the bylaws. And so it's a housekeeping change. So we have agreed to do that. In the needs assessment section on page 22 of the document, we have undergone assessments of the trauma system, and so it was recommended by our work group that we add the HRSA benchmarks, indicators, and scoring self-assessment results from 2007, 2011, and 2013 as a means of sort of monitoring the progress that we're making in system development, and so that was a major change to the plan. In the trauma system design section, beginning on page 34, we added a section related to disaster preparedness. And in policy development section on page 44, we included all of the documents that have been created since 2005, 2006. So since that time, we have developed trauma system regulations. We developed a trauma performance improvement plan, procedures related to how things should operate within the system. So all of those documents have now been added into this document, either in the appendix or in the body of the document. And then I think that's it for this particular plan. Then I'll move on to the Trauma System Performance Improvement Plan. This plan was last revised in 2009. Again, major housekeeping changes and reorganization of this document based on the recommended guidelines from the American College of Surgeons Resources for Optimal Care of the Injured Patient and also the Society of Trauma Nurses Trauma Outcomes and Performance Improvement document. On page 5, we added a definition of what is a trauma patient as a basis for how our decisions are made going forward. In the data collection and analysis section, we added a recommendation that the trauma centers in the county submit data to the Southern Nevada Health District in addition to the State Health Division, which is what is required by law. But this would provide us an additional opportunity to do the data analysis for decisions that are made in the system here. And then finally, again, the language was updated throughout to reflect the most recent changes in these two documents, and so that's it for that document. And in summary, we held a total of 17 meetings over the course of the last 18 months or so in looking at these documents. We had great participation from our partners in the EMS and trauma community. Dr. Files and Kim Dawkin are both here today, and you know, they attended many of these meetings and provided input throughout the process. In addition, we conducted 3 public workshops on January 8th, January 14th, and January 21st, and made some minor changes based on the input from those individuals who attended. And finally, we are recommending, or we took it to the Regional Trauma Advisory Board, and they unanimously endorsed all of the revisions. And so we're bringing this before you, these 3 documents before you today for your, again, consideration and adoption.
Any questions, board members?
Question?
Thank you. On the trauma system performance improvement, before I forget that, on the 3.7, the appeal process, was there anybody particularly that recommended the change to go to district court from an appeals from a hearing officer?
That was a recommendation by our legal counsel. They reviewed all of these documents and made some recommendations, and this was one of the recommendations they made.
And the appeal process would be if they didn't, they thought they were a level 1 versus a level 2, or what are the challenges that they would be bringing forth?
The appeal process, if a hospital desires to become a trauma center, the first step in the process is they have to come to the board.
Correct.
To seek authorization to move forward in the process to the state to become designated as a trauma center. So if the board were to decide that we didn't need an additional trauma center, because we have sufficient resources in the community right now, and in fact that may have a detrimental effect on the system by reducing volume to the 3 existing centers, then you may deny their request for authorization as a trauma center. If they were to appeal that process, this would be the mechanism that would be used.
I have concerns about taking it to district court. It's a very technical issue. It's a medically driven one, and it's not broken. So I think you're adding costs. Because there was 7 years ago, 6 years ago, an attempt to try to expand it, and which would have harmed those, because as you decrease the number of patients for those other trauma centers, it has an inverse effect on them. And I don't know that the courts, with no disrespect, would necessarily understand the complexity of that, and I think you'd almost make it political rather than not. So I would hope in that document we rethink that part of it, personally. That's my plan. Now back to the plan on the performance improvement. If I look at who currently is on the TMAC?
Representatives from the three trauma centers, so the trauma medical director and the trauma program manager. And then we have specialists. We have an anesthesiologist, an orthopedic surgeon, a neurosurgeon, an emergency department physician from a non-trauma hospital,
okay.
A representative from the EMS community, the coroner's office.
And how are they selected? Are they just recommended to the committee from those various organizations then?
There is a nomination process, and the individuals are appointed by Dr. Iser.
Okay. And then on the page 5... find my notes here. On the data collection, what do you currently ask for versus what you might be asking for that might be different?
What we currently ask for is a subset of the trauma registry data. Unfortunately, the state trauma registry has not been functional since 2007. So the trauma centers have agreed to provide us a subset of that information so that we have something upon which to base our decisions. And so we are asking that once the registry is back up and running, that they also submit data to us so that we have the ability to do that analysis here locally.
And I knew that they weren't doing that, and I thought it would be important that maybe this board ask our lobby team or someone else to really work on making sure that that is open. Because once you collect that data, it's just another impartial group that can disseminate. And I just think that's very important. And that's not something we've talked about in quite some time. On page 11, if I might, Mr. Chair, could you just explain the determination of judgments, mortality without opportunity for improvement? I'm assuming that's how you... what one of the things you look at when there is a review of a trauma-related death at a non-trauma center? Is that only the ones or any trauma?
Any trauma.
Okay.
So any of the hospitals. This is actually a process that's done internally by the trauma centers, again, using guidelines that have been created by the American College of Surgeons and the Society of Trauma Nurses, the trauma outcomes and performance improvement. This is the language that they use in determining whether or not, as stated there in Appendix H, it defines some general guidelines for how they reach those judgments. So they have an internal process whereby they have a medical peer review of cases,
right.
And then they bring those to the Trauma Medical Audit Committee, and they present only the ones where there are opportunities for improvement, because the understanding or the hope is that by sharing those lessons learned that it will improve outcomes for the entire system.
And so in the past, and Dr. Files is here, but we had an attempt to expand from competition, so to speak, rather than really looking at who does what best, in my opinion. And does any of this language give anybody a leg up, or is it equally distributed, I guess?
I think it's equally distributed, and that's the value of the internal process is then brought to the group as a whole. And so they present their case, and the members of the committee have an opportunity to ask questions, and if they disagree with the judgment, they can state that.
Okay.
It doesn't happen very often,
yeah.
I can tell you. They generally do a very thorough job internally, and they are sometimes their own worst critics, you know, as they bring the case
right.
forward.
So who's the EMS rep on the TMAC?
It is the individual who sits as the Regional Trauma Advisory Board representative. So we have an EMS representative.
Okay, so it's not from a particular business or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
Those individuals are, again, selected through a nomination process.
And then sometimes we have folks that are picked up in a very bad accident with a head injury, for example. They go to the closest hospital rather than to the trauma. And that is a delay in care for that individual. Do you look at those types of things?
We do.
Because that's another competition piece that goes in, because I've dealt with it in my district. And, I want the best quality of care quickest where people need to go. So that is part of what you review within here?
Exactly. In fact, we added specific language
to say that
care at a non-trauma center should also be evaluated through the TMAC process. Our desire is to create an inclusive system, and we recognize that trauma patients are sometimes taken to non-trauma hospitals, so we need to be able to review that care from a systems perspective.
And sometimes that's through the EMS. That's why I was curious which companies, because you got competition going on that way, and they really should be, in my opinion, going directly to whoever, level one for XYZ, level two for XYZ, so you don't have that delay in care. Regardless if it's closest, you should really be going to where it's the best service for the individuals.
And we have a very specific protocol that speaks to that, that's based on the CDC guidelines for triage of trauma patients in the field. And they are giving very clear guidance as to where those patients should be transported. And the only deviation that they're allowed from that is if in their judgment the patient's condition may be compromised by not going to the closest facility. And sometimes that is a non-trauma hospital, for instance, in a cardiac arrest situation. Mm-hmm. So we monitor that. We look at every single trauma call in the system.
Because we still have diversions to UMC, so I just want to make sure that we're minimizing that as well.
Right.
Thank you.
The trauma centers provide that data to us, and then we sync that up with the EMS data, and we monitor the out of areas as well. So we are watching that very closely. That's part of the surveillance we do for the system.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your patience. I just want to go back and just see if anybody else has any thoughts regarding changing the appeal process when it really wasn't broken and before.
Thank you for my patience.
PATI. No.
What is the process that we're replacing as far as these appeals go?
Perhaps either Annette or Heather could speak to it from a legal perspective. I can provide the explanation as I understand it.
Currently, the process is the respondent would request a hearing, and it would be from a hearing officer. Because we have not had any appeals in the past, we don't have a hearing officer specific to trauma regulations yet. So we would have to go into the community and find somebody with that expertise to be able to hear the matter. If they didn't like the result of the hearing officer, they would then be able to appeal it to this board. And if they didn't like what you as a board decided, then they would go to district court, and this simply truncates that process.
They would still be able to bring it to the board, or it would go directly to the district court?
It would go to the board, then it would go to district court.
So ultimately, everybody's had an opportunity to go to district court if they had chose.
I'm sorry?
Any applicant would have had the opportunity in the past and in the future now, still would have had the opportunity to go to district court.
Right.
What is being removed, as I perceive it, is one level of hearing officer, which doesn't seem like there is a expert hearing officer for this purpose.
Well, we would certainly be able to find one. There's enough expertise in the community should that happen.
But the board would ultimately make a decision after that hearing officer anyway, and that would still be in place.
Right.
I'd like to follow up with that then. Okay, so there's no shortage of experts in the hearing officer.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
There's not a shortage of experts that we would use.
No,
we would
be able to find one in the community, yes.
You know, as a board, I do think we should. I thought we were no longer in the loop. I thought it moved away from us. But, you know what, having it screened and having dealt with UMC issues, I'd rather have someone as an impartial board at least review the expertise part of it before it comes to us, because with no disrespect, I don't know how many of us know much about trauma situations, and you have no recommendation from anybody that was an impartial body. I just don't understand, if we haven't had one, what's broken and why are we fixing it? If they can already go to district court, fine, but I don't really see the rationale for taking out the hearing officer step. It might be resolved there. Why would we create more potential another potential problem.
Simply to truncate the process so that it gets your resolution faster. Because
you could resolve it at the hearing officer level. You're making a presumption, and then it costs money, and then you got to go find one of your outside attorneys, and then you got to do all this.
And if we've never had one, how do we know that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an assumption.
Commissioner Scow?
It does keep it local. Because sometimes if it goes to the state, they don't always understand the issues here.
Yeah, so I'm not arguing against the district court as the final. I just don't understand why we would remove a hearing officer that would get to the facts of the case before it comes to us so that we have something pared down to deal with. But especially since we've not had one, what's broken?
When there was some discussion that 6 or 7 years ago someone had applied for a trauma permit, and they were denied?
They were not. Because at the time we didn't have trauma regulations. It was actually a function of the state to do the designation, and there was concern about how that process went and losing local control over identifying our own needs. And so 450B-237 was changed in the 2005 legislative session to address that, and it delegated this responsibility to us. At that time, you know, we've only had the three centers. So UMC was our level one trauma center, and Sunrise came in as a level two, and then St. Rose came in as a level three. Since that time, we haven't had any applicants for trauma center authorization or designation.
So in the event of an appeal of a decision, option A is that it would go to an appeals hearing officer for a probably preliminary decision, then come to the board, then go to court.
Right.
And the proposal is to eliminate the appeals hearing officer decision, and it comes to the board, and then goes to court. Is that correct? Is that what we're going to be doing when we amend this?
Mm-hmm. It is. Yes.
Tell me that.
The decision is yours, and so that's how it was initially explained to me. That because this is your decision to deny the application, for you then to assign a hearing officer to review your own ruling. That typically the hearing officer is used for decisions made at the program level, where someone appeals something that I've done, and that perhaps we've done through the medical, the EMS and trauma system office, and they seek an appeal to that action through you, and you assign a hearing officer to review what the process was and whether or not it was appropriate. As it was explained to me, because as I've stated, you've already made the decision. For you then to assign a hearing officer to review your own decision and then report back to you.
So the decision comes to us.
That's
first.
Confusing. I didn't really. I was thinking usually you have appeal or hearing officer, board, and then court.
We would.
So we have it after?
Yeah.
I'd rather have someone vet that has expertise and then make the recommendation.
Wouldn't the district hire that expertise on a contract, should that eventuality occur, and advise the board as we proceeded with our decision?
Could, but why would you waste that money? I mean, part of when you look at a court case is you vet through your hearing officers what's a strength in our case versus what's a weakness, and if the board still... You don't have to take their recommendation. We could act whatever way we want, but at least you've got documentation on what the arguments were, what was the pro, what was the con. I mean, this is not a hill to die for, but I just think I think we're backwards even on the process. We really should have a hearing officer, then the board, and then district court.
The players, I would think, who would be involved in this kind of an application would be of significant substance and probably not frivolous. Be hard to imagine that. Jim?
Did none of the trauma participants have any issues with this change in process, and did any of the hospitals have any issue with this change in process?
They did not. At the public hearing, Mr. Sklamberg from Sunrise questioned why the change was made, and the explanation was given, and he was satisfied. And we have not received any other feedback about that. Just to take a step back, if the application were to come in, the office would first review the application. And then we would come to you with a recommendation, and that individual would have the opportunity at that time to defend their position, and we would explain to you why we agree or disagree, and then you would render your opinion. If they were not satisfied with your decision, that's when the appeal process would take
and
place.
Our
so there
rendering
is a vetting
of an opinion,
that goes on beforehand.
And our rendering of an opinion could include obeying this for a month while we hire an expert to advise us on the technical issues.
Like I said, it's not a hill to die for, but it's weird that we did it backwards in the first place. I mean, that's normally, I mean, even if we deny a business license, they go to a hearing officer. Doesn't come to us until you work up those steps, because a lot of stuff is resolved prior to. So, fine.
Any additional questions, board members? Okay. Someone want to make a motion?
Open it for public comment.
Oh, public comment, please. Does anyone wish to address this matter? Going once, going twice, gone. Close public hearing.
Move to approve with the change of language to include the exact language from the bylaws relative to the makeup of the board.
What language was
what?
That was on page 16 of the 16. Trauma.
There was some,
Mr. Jones had said some suggested change.
Okay. Edited language which was not exact and consistent with the bylaws. It describes the makeup of this board. And my request, part of my motion for approval, is to include the exact language from the bylaws in the description of the makeup of this board.
That's correct. The language that was originally in the document was not consistent with the specific language of the statute or the specific language of the bylaws. And this is just to make it consistent, that's all.
But that's already been corrected, correct?
It has not. Request came to us this week.
Okay.
And you're fine with that?
I am.
Okay. We have a motion.
Second.
We have a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Many months of work.
Thank you.
On our agenda item 5, sub 1, review, discuss administrative update, accreditation. Who's going to make that presentation?
As we had presented to the board several months ago, on a monthly basis, we'd like to have some individual or program from one of our divisions explained to the board. So it's an educational session. And this month, from the administrative division, we'd like to have Demetria Patton, who has joined us as the accreditation coordinator this past August, present an update on where we're at with accreditation. As you know, and as we've talked about accreditation in the past, that's a very significant undertaking, and want to make sure to keep the board not only involved but included in the status of where we're at with accreditation. Demetria.
Is the clicker?
Oh, okay.
Well, hello, everyone. My name is Demetria Patton, and I am the accreditation coordinator for the Southern Nevada Health District. And today, I'm going to provide you with an update regarding our process and just some accomplishments that we've had so far. So to begin the learning objectives, I really want to provide you all with information regarding what is public health accreditation, why it's important for SNHD to apply, and where we are in the process and where are we going. So to begin, what is public health accreditation? I did provide you all with some definitions there, but I did want to provide you with some background information regarding public health accreditation. So public health accreditation is governed by the Public Health Accreditation Board, also known as FAB, and it was launched in 2011, and it's a process for tribal, state, local, and territorial health departments to become accredited. And so this board is comprised of public health leaders from across the nation, and health departments have the ability to apply for accreditation and prove that they meet the 10 essential services of public health. And so one of the main ways that health departments become accredited is that they have to prove that they meet the standards and measures. And so FAB has delivered a 200 and some page document full of standards and measures, and a health department has to provide documentation to showcase that they meet those standards and measures. So that's basically in a nutshell what FAB is. So I wanted to include this particular slide in regards to the national accreditation goal, and I really enjoy this slide because I think essentially that's what accreditation is about. It's about improving the quality of the services you provide to the individuals you serve and also the performance of your agency. And although we have just started the process, I can definitely say that we're seeing some improvements in our processes, in our procedures, in the way that we operate as an agency. So where are we? In regards to accreditation, it's a 7-step process, and I'm going to go through these very quickly, but if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. So the first step is step one, and it's the pre-application phase, and this is where we are. But with the first step, an agency looks at basically, do they have the tools they need to apply for accreditation? And the one thing that I like about FAB is that they have a pre-assessment checklist. So as an agency, you determine, okay, do you have an accreditation coordinator? Do you have individuals within your staff or within your agency that you can pull to select documentation or really drive this effort forward? Are you meeting the 10 essential services of public health? Because you want to make sure that you're going to be successful before you go into the process. And so we've done all of those things. I'm the accreditation coordinator, and I'm going to talk a little bit later about our A team and how we're moving forward. So step two is the application process. And so we're moving towards this step. Step two is, and I wanted to go back just and explain one thing. In the pre-application phase, there's a statement of intent that the agency must submit to FAB, and that's basically putting FAB on notice that we as an agency, as the health district, plan to apply for accreditation, and we've submitted that in January of 2015. So we have submitted our statement of intent, and now we're working towards the step two, which is the application phase. And during this step, you submit your community health assessment, your community health improvement plan, and your strategic plan. And that would be the strategic plan for our particular agency. And in addition to that, and this is where you all come in, FAB really wants to see that your board is supporting your desire to become accredited as an agency. So when we apply for our application, we have to have a letter of support from the board, just so FAB knows that you all are aware that we're applying for accreditation and that you support that particular process. In addition to that, FAB wants to see a org chart or organizational chart. So just a recap, we would need our community health assessment, our community health improvement plan, our organizational chart, and then a letter of support from the board to apply for accreditation. So the next step, once we apply and submit those documents, FAB is going to do a cursory overview of those things, making sure that we have everything we need. So they're going to look at it for completeness. So they're going to look at our CHA, they're going to look at our CHIP and our strategic plan to determine if it's complete. It's everything in there, what FAB is looking for, basically. So the third step is documentation selection, selection and submission. And this is one of the most important steps in the process because, like I said to you before, FAB has standards and measures. And one of the most important ways, or the only way, an agency can prove that they should be accredited is if they provide proof or documentation that they're meeting the standards and measures. And the only way to do that is if you provide documentation. And so during this process, the health district will submit roughly 300 to 400 documents to showcase that we're meeting the 10 essential services of public health, which is the standards and measures that FAB has basically comprised or created for us to review and submit that documentation for. So after step three, we move to the site visit phase. So after we submitted our documentation, they review the documentation, and since we have satellite locations, we can choose where FAB, where the site visitors are coming. So we can have them come here, we can have them visit one of our satellite locations, and they'll do a walkthrough. They'll walk around the agency and ask individuals, do you know that your health district is applying for accreditation? What do you know about accreditation? In addition to that, they may interview the board, members of the board. What do you all know about FAB? Do you know that you all are applying for accreditation? What do you know exactly? So they may interview you all. They may interview our community partners. They may interview some of the individuals from our A team. So that's basically what's going to happen during that site visit phase. They're going to review that documentation, ask any questions that they may have, and then interview SNHD staff, the board, and our community partners. So the next step is the accreditation decision. So after we've done all of that, the board is going to convene, and they're going to determine, based on the accreditation report that the site visitors comprise, should we be accredited? And from what I understand, an agency, there hasn't been an agency that has not been accredited. If there's issues within the particular, with your documentation or with some of your community health assessments or community health improvement plan or your strategic plan, you get a corrective action plan. So from that action plan, you're able to meet those deficiencies and kind of cure the things that may be problems for FAB. So after that, you go into step six, which is the reports. And I really wanted to stress this because FAB is not something that you do one time and we take a picture and we get a plaque and we put it on the wall. It's a continuous process because FAB wants to see that, okay, you have your CHA, you have your, which is your community health assessment, you have your community health improvement plan, you have your strategic plan, you have your workforce development plan and your quality improvement plan, your performance management plan, but how are you monitoring those plans? How are you keeping those things going? And so FAB wants to see yearly reports from all of those particular plans to make sure that you, whatever you say you're going to do as an agency, whatever objectives, whatever strategic priorities that you say that you're going to complete, how are you monitoring those things? How are you accomplishing those things? So it's a continuous process. This is just not a one-time thing. So after the reports, we move into reaccreditation. And reaccreditation happens every 5 years, and that's why that step before is very important, because you want to continually update those reports and monitor the things that you say that you're going to do, your indicators and things of that nature. This step is pretty interesting because it happens every 5 years. And like I said before, FAB was established in 2011. So the health departments that are accredited, none of them have been accredited for 5 years. So as we move forward in the process and as other health departments move forward, we'll receive more information regarding this last step. So that's, in a nutshell, the steps of FAB. If you all have any questions, please feel free to ask.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Woods.
So I guess my question is this. You had a slide here that talks about the national accreditation goal.
Mm-hmm.
The goal of the voluntary national accreditation program is to improve and protect the health of the public by advancing the quality and performance of state, local, tribal, and territorial public health departments. And you're talking a lot about meeting the 10 essential services. Now, how exactly, with the closing of the North Las Vegas Clinic, do you honestly think you're meeting that? Because, you haven't got a new service, new means of service of providing for the residents of North Las Vegas. You've already closed down the clinic. You're talking about doing the same thing in Henderson. You have, right now, 230,000 people without service. You're looking at bringing that number up to over 400, almost 500,000. And I don't see how your reports can possibly reflect that you're meeting those 10 essential services under those circumstances.
Well, just to answer that question, and Andy, you may answer as well, I just want to say that we're in the beginning stages of the FAB process. We haven't submitted our documentation. We haven't submitted our or even completed our community health assessment, our community health improvement plan, and our strategic plan. A lot of those documents, especially those first three, are going to inform what we need to do as an agency. Like I said before, we just completed our gap analysis, and just to give you a little bit of information about that, we basically assessed the standards and measures against what we have and the documentation we have as an agency. So a lot of the things we're doing now is a preliminary, but once we have those things in place, I think we'll be more informed in moving forward with the decisions that we're making. So,
And I'd like to add to that, in that the accreditation board, when they're looking at the operations of an organization, it's how they are organized and how they function and how they're meeting their goals and objectives as outlined in the strategic plan. One of the foundations of the strategic plan is to do a community health assessment. Mm-hmm. And in that community health assessment, what you really look at is how the community is being serviced. What are the issues, the health issues within the community? And then going into the community health improvement plan, how are you going to address those issues and take care of them? The reason that this is so important relative to your question is that we are in the process right now of collecting data. We're going to have our first iteration of the data available next month, during the month of March, on what the issues are within the community and what issues we are going to undertake as a community to be able to address those health issues.
Well, I
so
certainly
it's
look
very
forward
much
to
of a data. It's very much of a data-driven process. And the data will determine not only the issue itself, but one of the things that we're very sensitive to is the access of services within our particular community. Again, in
well,
the
North Las
in
Vegas
the area
residents can't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I look forward to seeing the data.
I wasn't finished with what I was saying. What I was going on to say is that we are acutely aware of the needs within North Las Vegas, and that's why we had a site there to begin with. Actually, this is the second site that we had. The first site that we had, we knew serviced at least four times as many clients
correct
as the area that we're currently in. Right now, we're spending just under $500,000 a year to serve 12 patients per day. And what it is actually throwing good money after bad in providing a service in a location that is a wrong location. Recognizing that, recognizing the financial issues that we face as a district, recognizing the cuts in staff that we've had to make, the cuts in programs that we've had to make, and the recommendations that you're going to be seeing coming along with the budget for this year, we said rather than continuing to hemorrhage money in that particular location, we are much better off to stop operations there where we know that we are not providing the access that's needed, look for another location, and find some other way to serve a broader spectrum of the population. We also have looked at the data within North Las Vegas and recognize that our site, between our site here and in East Las Vegas, that we are servicing the North Las Vegas population.
That is
in
not
other
true,
words,
sir.
Yeah, I have the data right in front of me. If you'd
well,
like to go well, over
good,
it after this
you'll
meeting,
have
I'd like
about
to go over
2,000
that
people that were going to the original site, and you did not pick up 2,000 additional people that you're servicing at the East Las Vegas Clinic, and I can show you those numbers.
Okay,
and they have been
I
presented in the past
to
this board.
I'll be happy to review the data with you after the meeting.
That is fine.
I do have it with
but,
me.
And I don't necessarily disagree with your assessment. What I do disagree with is the fact that you have not come up with an alternative method of service, and yet you've closed the clinic now. I mean, to go ahead and close something when you don't have an alternate means of service in place, to me, is where this
okay, we need to bring the discussion made back on point, which is the accreditation presentation. And
well, but I think that when
you're, I understand.
When you're not addressing some of your most medically underserved.
You're free to vote against a resolution to proceed with accreditation if it comes to that.
Oh, I do not. I support accreditation.
Thank you. I think. And I was on the on this commission when a councilwoman was a member, and when they closed the original clinic, so I knew that that would be sensitive. I think the numbers will help prove out that you do need an additional location, where that location ought to be, because the one that was selected, unfortunately, wasn't the right place. The need is absolutely there, and since accreditation deals with underserved and gap areas, I think that that should drive sooner rather than later where that location needs to go, rather than just waiting for the accreditation process. And I think that's where the councilwoman's coming from. And I think you would be able to do that. I would just ask where the budget is, because accreditation, while all, even if schools, there's an ongoing cost. And I don't know in your documentation. I know we had it in one of our budget presentations, but I can't remember. And maybe it's something you can get us down the road. I don't have a problem personally with us moving towards accreditation, but we have to look at those longer-term impacts and then what funding needs are there, because sometimes you create expectations that you can't deal with if you don't have the revenue that comes into play.
So So is that a question?
For down the road, just on the budget part of it.
How much is accreditation going to cost us?
Correct.
Over a five-year period, I believe it's $37.5 that we're paying for accreditation.
Right around that number. The thing about accreditation is it's a one-time fee. And so we would pay that when we submit our application. So it's one time, and then they have payment plans, if you want to call it, that, and you can pay it either over 3 years or over 5 years, or you can make that one-time payment.
So that's the joining, the voluntary joining part of it, the 37.5. But when someone identifies, then you're weak in immunization, you're weak here, you need to improve this, you need to improve that, that's ongoing costs that we need to be aware of as we do our budgeting process. And there's just always hidden costs, there's more staffing costs, all those factors, 41 people from different divisions having to meet takes away from their time. Accreditation can be very impactful to delivering the program they're currently delivering. So I think we just need to be sensitive as a board that that's part of what's out there. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Is your job duties 100% accreditation?
Yes.
So you got one FTE already,
mm-hmm.
and we're at step one. So that probably needs to be a follow-on for our next meeting. And Councilwoman Woods, I didn't mean to cut you off. I understand the passion with which you feel that, and we'll get there. I think I agree with you.
I have no doubt.
I agree with you that you need a location out there. Mr. Jones?
2 points, and I think that accreditation, to my expectation, gives us direction for budgeting. It, per se, is not an additional cost. It is basically a system that gives us best guidance for where the money should be spent and how it can be most effectively used to benefit public health.
Exactly.
Our question is, have we seen yet where accreditation has had any impact on agencies' ability to get federal grants? I know that's sort of an expectation that sooner
Definitely.
Or later it's going to be necessary to be competitive for grants.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up. I was actually talking to Deb Williams, and she was telling me that that question is actually starting to appear on grant applications. Is your health district, is your health department accredited? And I also wanted to share this with you all. I just recently reviewed the NACHO Forces of Change survey, and accreditation is a force of change now. So it's more information is coming, especially regarding new funding streams and also how it's important or impacting those grants. So, okay.
Any other questions?
Agreed. Is this the sole accreditation agency, or are there others out there?
No, this is just FAB.
This is it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you have any idea how many health districts are so far accredited? Or they've gotten the process since 2011? It's only 3 years.
It only has been 3 years. And I don't want to tell you the wrong number, but I don't want to say the wrong number. So I'll make sure to provide you with that information.
The last number that I saw, which was in last month's publication, was 52.
Okay.
Okay.
Out of how many?
All right. So. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Board, do we want to resolve?
I would make a motion to move forward with the process to make sure that we have ongoing updates on costs and that at some point you get us the number of accredited versus how many are available to be accredited, because
okay.
that makes a difference as well. So that would be my motion, Mr.
And,
okay.
and would you
Second.
Would you authorize, as an amendment, authorize a letter be prepared on behalf of the board supporting the organization?
Correct. I would make that part of the motion for the letter.
Second.
And I wasn't finished with my presentation, but nevertheless, still had a few more slides.
Well, fire away.
Okay, thank you. So I did want to provide some accomplishments, and let me go back really quickly. So this is our accreditation team. This is actually a picture of us at work. And like I said before, we have 41 members, staff members from every division within the agency. And that particular A team, or their accreditation team, is composed of 6 subcommittees. And so I talked a little bit about the community health assessment, the community health improvement plan. So our subcommittees, we have a community health assessment subcommittee, and that subcommittee is focused on creating the community health assessment along with FAB standards and measures that they've been assigned. We have a CHIP subcommittee, and that subcommittee is responsible for the community health improvement plan. along with additional FAB standards and measures. We have a strategic planning subcommittee. That particular subcommittee is responsible for the strategic plan and other FAB standards and measures. We have a communication subcommittee, and that subcommittee is very important because, like I said to you before, when we have our site visit, FAB wants to see that it's not a siloed process. They want to see that we have branded this out to the entire health district, that everyone knows that we are applying for accreditation, and they've done an amazing job. We have a documentation standards and measures subcommittee, and they're responsible for creating a process in which we'll be able to store and keep track of all of these documents. Like I said before, it's going to be probably 400 to 500 documents, so they have to really make sure that we stay on task with that. But this is our A team, and they've done an amazing job, and I think one of the reasons why we are where we are and how we're accomplishing so much is because of our accreditation team. And our team meets biweekly, and then the subcommittees have their additional meetings as well. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this. I know that Dr. Iser provided this update at our last board meeting, but we actually submitted our statement of intent in January of 2015. And like I said before, this just puts FAB on notice that we are going to apply for accreditation. Now, with the statement of intent, we had to submit it 6 months before or no more than 12 months. So we plan to submit our application in September of 2015. So it was a great time to submit our statement of intent. And as you can see, Dr. Iser's there. He actually pushed the button with that one. So, and these are just some additional FAB accomplishments that I wanted to share with you all, and I'll be very quick. The 2015 Clark County Community Health Assessment, that will be complete in March. And I know that there's been some talk about, you know, where we need centers and things of that nature. And that data will really kind of drive that process to determine, okay, what are the issues in our community, what we need to focus on, and where we need to provide those services. So that document will be very beneficial for that particular process. I wanted to talk to you all a little bit about community engagement. We have a steering committee that's comprised of community partners. We meet monthly, and that steering committee, we have UNLV, we have UN, we have the American Heart Association, we have Clark County School District, and we get together and we talk about the community health assessment, we talk about the community health improvement plan and how we want to work together to address these issues that we have in our community. I talked a little bit about the FAB gap analysis and documentation, that's the most important thing. And so with our A team, we're focusing on what documents do we have now, what things are we doing to meet the FAB standards and measures. And surprisingly, we're doing a lot of this stuff. We just have to document and we have to find those documents. The next thing, the FAB national training. I know that you all received an email regarding the national training that we had last week. And FAB National actually came to Las Vegas, and they hosted a training for us, and they provided us information regarding everything regarding documentation, what we need to do, how to be successful, and things of that nature. And I actually have a nifty flash drive, so if you all want some additional reading, I can provide you with all of those documents, and you can take a look at those things. The next thing is FAB branding. I talked a little bit about our communications subcommittee and how they're doing an excellent job. And I don't know if you all saw this, but coming in, if you come out, we have our banner at the top of the wall. So when you leave, just make sure you turn around and take a look up, because our banner is up there and we have a fantastic logo and it really plays on the Las Vegas sign. So just take a look at that. In addition to that, we have an accreditation side dish that provides updates regarding accreditation and where we are. We have an accreditation page, which is on the SNHD website that you all can take a look at if you just want more information about accreditation. One of the things that I'm seeing now is improvement in our processes and our procedures. We now have a policy development team that's meeting, and we're getting our policies in order, making sure that everyone within our agency knows where they are, how to create policies and things of that nature. One of the things that we recently created was a process in regards to IT. So that's what I really want to stress. With accreditation, you see the gaps that you have as an agency. You see the processes that you don't have, and you're able to create and meet those deficiencies because of FAB. So we're starting to see some improvement in regards to our processes and our procedures. The last thing is we're having a district-wide training in regards to quality improvement and performance management. Our first one is taking place on March 3rd, and it's about everything regarding quality improvement, the basics of that, because essentially that's what FAB is about, improving the quality of services, improving the performance of your agency. So I know that was a lot to take in, but those are some of the accomplishments. So this is a timeline, and I just briefly want to go over this. On the left side, you see that there's an activities column, and you see moving forward to the right, there's timelines, and then there's some guidance regarding other health departments, but I just wanted to showcase to you and provide you with some dates. So the first thing we had to do was submit our statement of intent to put FAB on notice that we're applying for accreditation. We did that in January of 2015. That statement of intent was approved the same day, and so now we have access to the application. And so, like I said to you before, that's the next step. So we would need to submit our community health assessment, our community health improvement plan, and our strategic plan, along with the letter from the board supporting our process, and along with our organizational chart. So we plan to submit that in September of 2015. So after we submit our application, I then have to participate. Well, let me back up. FAB is going to review that, like I said, for completeness, just to make sure that everything that we are supposed to have are in those particular documents. After that, I go to an accreditation coordinator's training, and that's going to happen in November of 2015. And so moving forward, this is the last page of the timeline. So after I go to that training in November of 2015, we get access to EFAB. Now, EFAB is the electronic system to store all of the documentation that I've been talking about, those 400 pieces of paper that we have to submit to prove that we're meeting the FAB standards and measures. That's the system that's going to store all of that those documents, and they're going to check and make sure that we're meeting those FAB standards and measures. I'm almost done, I promise. So this is a slide that I really wanted to share with you all, and this is basically how does the Board of Health fit in. And there's actually a domain, and it's called Domain 12, and that domain focuses on maintaining capacity to engage the public health governing entity. That would be the Board of Health. FAB really wants to make sure that we are engaging you all in the accreditation process, that you support the accreditation process, and that you all are just kept informed and that you're engaged. Now, if you want to see the actual standards and measures to see what the documentation will be, a lot of it will be the agenda items or the agendas from this particular meeting. It would be the meeting minutes and the presentations that occur at these particular meetings. But if you want to see those things, I can provide those to you. And the last slide here is just, if you would like to learn more, I talked a little bit about the accreditation page that we have, the accreditation side dish, and all of those different things. And if you want to become certified in FAB, you can actually go to the FAB website and you can become certified. So that is all that I have. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. Yes.
Mr. Dobine?
You asked back at the retreat meeting that we had for the board members to go through that accreditation process. Have we kept up our end?
Yes, I believe I had one person that is FAB certified. So at your leisure, please feel free to go to the website. It's four videos that you have to watch, and they provide you everything you want to know regarding accreditation. And then after those, each video, you take a test, basically, an assessment of the information that you learn from those videos, and then you become FAB certified. So that's always available. Yes.
I believe United Way did a community assessment, and included in that was a health component. You might want to just get that to look at as your subcommittee works forward.
Yes, and I did want to speak to that. We actually have United Way on our steering committee, so we've been working very closely with them.
Unfortunately, it looks like North Las Vegas just hired the CEO.
Yeah, I heard that.
My motion would stand, Mr. Chair. If there's
any additional questions or comments, I have one. Are we going to be presented next month's board meeting, at next month's board meeting, the community health assessment?
No.
What we're doing is we've got the first iteration, and we're this community health assessment group that's been working, which are the community health partners. We're presenting it to that group at our March meeting, and I'm not sure of the exact date. It's a couple days prior to the board meeting. It's very close to that, so we won't have had chance to have a thorough discussion and go through it. But we'd be happy to present the data and the information and make it available, actually, as soon as it's available then. But we won't be prepared to go through the a thorough analysis of it. You know, it'd just be raw data.
Mm-hmm. It'll be another month, 2 months,
yeah.
You think?
Well, actually, by the time that we get to April is when we're going to present that data that has been looked at a second time by the Community Health Assessment Group go to Community Health Planning with some direction on that. So I would say by April,
mm-hmm.
we'd be ready to do that. And we could go through a very thorough discussion of that data.
Yes.
All that merge with when we will next make a budget decision. Seems like it would be a valuable tool to have as we go into the next budget cycle.
Well, the budget actually is going to be presented at the March meeting, so it's out of sync with that from the budget perspective. But at the same time, we've still got our priorities that we've got to be meeting anyhow. And I think one of the things that Demetria made a point of is that what we're doing as a health district is exactly what a health district is supposed to be doing. We're not recreating the wheel. We're not recreating what we're doing. It's how we're doing it so that the programs and the services that we offer are stationary. I mean, we're not moving them other than they're influenced by the data that we collect. But we do that on a moving basis anyhow. As we get data, as we get information, we change our programs and our services to meet that data direction. So, you know, it's not really changing how we do business. And as far as the budget and how that syncs in with that, we do that anyhow. So this is just an additional helping process to help us do that in a more formalized way.
Any additional questions, Board? All right, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
And opposed? Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Under agenda item 5 sub 2, review and discuss assessment of maternal child health home visitation program.
I would like to introduce Dr. Rebecca Scheer, who is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Nevada School of Medicine, also the section chief of gastroenterology and nutrition, as well as the vice chair of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Nevada at UMC. Dr. Scheer has put together an analysis and a review of the maternal child health program. As you will remember, with the funding of the maternal child health program last March during the budgeting process, Dr. Iser committed that we would take a look at the statistics and any information that we could collect and give the board an update and a report on the maternal child health program. And Dr. Scheer has done that, and I would like to turn the program over to Dr. Scheer.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Scheer, Rebecca Scheer. And I'd like to speak to what Ms. Perlstein said earlier. That's correct. This data collection was not done by them. It was done by myself under Dr. Iser's direction, and he wanted this done. And the way that I came about doing this was that I'm also working on my master's in public health, and Dr. Iser reached out to the Community Health Sciences Dean asking for someone who would be able to do an assessment of the maternal child health program, and I was indicated as someone who might be qualified to do that. So that's how I came to obtain this data and work through this assessment. So I just wanted to talk first, give you a little bit of background on the maternal child health program. It's under the Community Health Nursing Division, and currently they run the Kids Clinic, the Refugee Health Program, the Nurse Family Partnership, which is known as NFP, if you heard that addressed before, Healthy Start, which is a new evidence-based home visiting program, the CPS Nurse Liaison, and the Maternal Child Health Team. And the current staff breakdown, I think one of these numbers might be slightly incorrect, but as of when this presentation was made, that NFP currently has 9 staff, and that is a grant-funded program, NFP is. Kids Clinic has 2 staff, CPS Liaison is 1, Refugee Health has 1.5, Healthy Start has 5, and that's also grant funded. Maternal Child Health has 2.5. I think that may have gone down a little bit over the past few weeks, and there's 1 auxiliary staff. The data, I put this data set includes 5 nurses because at the time of the data collection, that's how many nurses were working on the Maternal Child Health program, and so that was collected from 5 different nurses. On the Southern Nevada Health District, then a maternal child health nurse program states that it provides health counseling, referrals, and assessments to pregnant women, mothers, infants, and children living in Clark County. So that's their statement of purpose. This is also on the website for what they provide in services to their clients. They provide health screening, health counseling, parenting skills education, newborn assessment, nutrition and feeding counseling, referrals to doctors for mothers and children to get proper medical care, and referrals to other agencies or providers if needed. Referrals to the maternal child health program come from several sources. One is UMC Labor and Delivery, the NICU, basically. They also have CPS liaison and are referred from other CPS workers. Health districts, actually in other communities who have people who move to Las Vegas, refer patients to this, or other community health organizations. And you can do self-referrals, and there is a phone number on the website. This is taken directly from the website, where a mother can call and ask for services. This is the referral breakdown for the last 3 years, 2012 through 2014. And as you can see, the UMC was the biggest source of referrals for the maternal child health program. And that I will address a little bit later as to why it may seem that that is a pro for the program. It actually caused a large labor burden on the staff, and I'll address that a little bit later. And these were these admissions were the patients that were admitted. So you look at 2014, it would be January 1st through August 1st, only 154 of those referrals were actually admitted to the program. So you can see there's a huge labor that goes into figuring out which clients are going to be admitted to the program versus how many are actually referred to the program. The current data collection includes 98 infants and children, 21 women who were either antepartum or postpartum in their admission to the program. They were all admitted between January 1st, 2014 and August 1st, 2014. The reason for those dates are that at August 1st, the maternal child health program started to do different data entry, as Ms. Perlstein said. So the data entry that was done prior to August 1st is different than the data entry that was done after August 1st by the maternal child health nurse program nurses. So I only looked at data that was collected before that time. And all of the patients were discharged before December 31st, 2014. So the data does not look at some of the patients that are currently still enrolled in the program because the data is not complete. And this was under 5 community health nurses. About March, I think it was, I had a meeting with Dr. Iser and the team, the maternal child health team, and we looked at some proposed outcomes that the team might be able to look at to give some more data, evidence-based, to what they were actually trying to achieve in the field. And some of the things that we came up with, and they came up with, and we agreed with them that these were important, were the percent of infants and children that were up to date on immunizations at discharge from the program, percent of women and infants and children with health insurance at discharge from the program, percent of children and infants that received at least 2 well child visits with their medical care provider at discharge from the program, percent of women that enrolled prenatally that received a prenatal care visit within 8 weeks of enrolling in the program, percent of infants that received the second newborn screening at discharge, percent of women enrolled that are screened for interpersonal violence at discharge, and percent of women who enroll prenatally that initiate breastfeeding, percent of necessary referrals completed by enrolled women and infants and children. So these were developed about March or April, and the new data entry reflected these outcomes. The data that was entered prior to August 1st, which is when they finally had it in place, did not specifically look at these specific outcomes, although they were trying to measure them indirectly. So the referral sources, as you can see, that were admitted to the program, NICU only was 72% of the admissions. NICU along with CPS was 7% of the admissions, CPS alone 10%. Olive Crest is a community-based organization that deals with high-risk families, and they referred two patients. And as you can see, some came from other sources. There were three previous clients in that mix, and they came from all various categories. Next, you can see where the most common zip codes were for our mothers and children. 89108 was by far the highest percentage of admitted patients. It was number one for both the mothers and the infants. 89104 was a close second. With both the mothers and children, it was number two. So, and then the pink one at the top indicates that it was high for the mothers but not the infants, and blue indicates that it was a high zip code range for the infants but not the mothers, and purple is for both. So if that gives you an indication of... Now, there were a lot less women who were admitted to the program, obviously, than children. So the numbers are kind of skewed a little bit. And I only picked the top zip codes. Obviously, there was one or two from other zip codes. The stars in the mother's zip codes indicate that those are programs that are included in NFP. So NFP is a grant-funded program, and there are certain eligibility criteria, including zip codes. And these two zip codes are included in NFP. So I don't know why they were not admitted to NFP. It doesn't apply for the infants because NFP also requires that you are admitted prenatally.
Tell me again what NFP is.
It's the family program, nurse family program. Nurse Farm Partnership, sorry, yes. So it's an evidence-based, grant-funded. I think, how long have we been a part of that?
2013.
I think we had it expanded recently, but it's been quite a few years. Yes.
It was started in 2008, and correction there. The majority of it is on the county funding. I only have two nurses that are currently grant-funded on that. I have a small grant from the Attorney General's office, which actually expires in July, and that covers some of the operating expenses for the rest of the team. So it is not entirely grant funded, but it's been going on since 2008. The reasons that those individuals may have been not admitted by NFP is because they did not meet NFP criteria, which is it has to be a first-time mother, may not have been a first pregnancy, and they have to be enrolled early in the pregnancy, not later than 28 weeks gestation. These babies may have been farther along in the pregnancy.
Right. The NFP does have strict criteria, which is part of why there were so many referrals to this program also. It's all prenatal for the NFP, so that's part of the shortcoming of that program. They can't pick up infants afterwards. Okay, so some of the reasons that the infants and children were discharged, now this is just infant and children, we can go through the moms, but there were many more children. There were 100 children. So 35% of them were lost to follow-up, which means that the maternal child health nurse who was on that case would call the family. If they had to leave a message, they would leave a message. They would then call back, leave a message, see if they could get in contact with them. They would then send a letter. Sometimes the families would call the nurse back after the letter was sent, and sometimes they would not, and then the nurse would either go back to the family or close the case. So that's what loss to follow-up usually entailed. 20% of the mothers declined services after a few visits, and 43% the goals were met, and those goals are the ones that we talked about earlier, immunizations being received, primary care physicians being seen, and WIC being in place. So taking those outcomes that we started to measure more heavily in August, newborn screen, 83% of these were completed. This number, you have to take into account, most of the infants that were admitted were from the NICU. So this gets done in the NICU. Pretty much no child leaves the NICU without having their newborn screen. And if it's within the 2 weeks, then they also have that one done as well. And every child that leaves the NICU has the card, even if it's not within the 2 weeks, where the parents are told they can come back to UMC or the physician's office with the card to get the newborn screening done. For 10%, there was no documentation. For 4% of the patients, which is actually four, which since there was only 98 patients, it actually makes the statistics kind of easy. There was a plan for the newborn screen, but there was no follow-up data. There was nothing documented. And the date of completion, so part of the new documentation is that they actually write the date, the physical date of when this was done, was only done in 37%. And that's a part of the documentation issue that the nurses had with the old system. There was no set documentation. Immunizations. 64% of them received two-month immunizations. 8%, I could not find documentation, and 26% were lost to follow-up. That means that I did not include the hepatitis B given at birth as a up-to-date vaccination status for an infant that was admitted, since if you are born in a hospital in Southern Nevada, you receive hepatitis B without any basically decision-making of the mother. So that's not dependent on the mother. I only did immunizations that were dependent on the mother's ability to obtain these for her children. So 64% had two-month immunizations, and 26% of the patients were lost before 2 months. Four-month immunizations of the patients that were followed, 42% had documentation, and another 46% were lost before their four-month immunizations were obtained. So one of the goals for outcomes or goals met was that infants received were up to date on their immunizations at discharge from the program. The one thing that I saw that was maybe could have been, I'll just say this, that a lot of the infants were discharged from the program before 4 months. And so that means that their immunizations might have been up to date for 2 months, but not for 4 months. So that means that they only had one set of immunizations, and then we don't know what happened to their four-month immunizations. So at discharge, 62% of them were up to date. So that means they had their two-month or their four-month or their six-month or however long they were followed. 29% were lost to follow-up before they even had immunizations, as you saw on the other slide. And only half of the infants were followed past 4 months. So there's only 50 infants that were actually followed in the program after 4 months of age or through their four-month immunizations. Just to give you a background on those statistics for up-to-date versus two-month versus four-month. Well-child checks. Most children had their first well-child check. The date was sometimes lacking, but most of the nurses did document that the children had been seen by a primary care physician. The second well-child check was sometimes a little bit harder to distinguish. However, most of these children were from the NICU. Therefore, they had subspecialists that they went and saw, specialists, and a lot of those were documented. And so those were included as children who had a second well-child visit, since that is a large burden for these parents to overcome to get their children to these subspecialists. But the well-child check was not documented for 56% of them. It was probably assumed and probably talked about, but it wasn't documented in the notes. Infants with documented primary care provider was at least 94%. There were only one or two who fell through the cracks, and unfortunately, those were tough families. Insurance status on admission, 40%. On discharge was 70%. Patients who had no insurance at admission was 17%, and pending was 32%. So you can see that some of the pending actually did go through, and maternal child health nurses really did provide phone numbers and paperwork and even went on the internet for some of these families to help them figure out if they had Medicaid, if they were pending Medicaid, or if they were eligible for Medicaid. And then no documentation for some of them as well. Once again, a lot of these babies did have pending Medicaid because they were from the NICU, but the maternal child health nurses did help the families navigate the system because a lot of them were still pending when they were discharged from the NICU. WIC, so 59% of them had WIC on admission, and 21% I didn't know. A lot of the non-documentation was for actually breastfeeding infants. the nurses did not document if the mothers or the infants were getting WIC if they were breastfeeding. But so there was a large percentage of mothers who were actually breastfeeding, which is good. We just don't know if they were receiving WIC benefits. And on discharge, 70% of them. And as you can see, some of our patients obviously didn't qualify for WIC. Some of them were military families or had other private insurance or something like that. I thought I had changed it. I apologize for that. One thing that I did notice was a huge strength for the maternal child health nurses was they checked the sleeping environment a lot, which I think is huge, especially for some of our populations and these babies that have a lot of medical conditions. So there was a documented crib check in 54%. I'm sure that was probably higher, but this was even just what they documented. I found 37 incidences of unsafe sleeping environments. In 13 of those, there were no cribs at all in the home, or twins were sleeping in the same bed. So they provided 13 cribs for these infants. They also found co-sleeping. They also found unsafe sleeping conditions with like blankets, pillows piled up in infants' cribs, and prone sleeping, and they addressed all of these. They even stated that they physically took out blankets and pillows from the infants' cribs. So that was something they weren't even measuring, but that I found in my data collection that I thought was a great intervention that they were able to do. So the mothers, as you can see, most of them were from the NICU also, so they were tagged on with the moms, or tagged on with the infants for various reasons that the maternal child health nurse noted that the mother might benefit from services. CPS, a few, and NFP, those were the ones, like Margarita said, that did not qualify for NFP. 23% of them were lost to follow-up, 14% were discharged or declined services, and 62 of them, the goals were met because most of the time the maternal child health nurse would identify a issue and then they would work on it, and then when they completed that issue, they would say that their goal was met, and then they would continue to follow the infant but not necessarily write notes on the mother, and that's how that is determined. So all the women that were admitted antepartum had prenatal care, and there were only 3 patients. So follow-up visit with provider at 6 weeks postpartum, only 38%. And that number on the next slide no matter how much the nurses tried, a lot of that number did not improve because of issues like immigration status, not having insurance, not having a provider, having been a drop-in for the labor and delivery as it was. So the maternal child health nurses, to their credit, really tried to get these moms in to see providers, but some of them just did not have the resources to do that. Interpersonal violence screen was documented in 67% of the cases. The issue that the nurses find with this is actually that we don't have a standardized screening tool. They basically assess the situation and the family, the interaction between the family, and ask if there is any interpersonal violence or any concerns that the mother has towards people that are living in the environment. Reproductive life cycle screening was documented 84%, and they did encourage planning of next infants and receiving some sort of birth control from their provider, and also made sure that the mothers informed the providers that they were breastfeeding if that was the case, so that appropriate birth control could be given to these mothers. And depression screen was documented in 67%, and they used an Edinburgh screen in some of them. Some of the nurses documented that they used a evidence-based screening tool for that. Actually, they did find some moms who did have depression and were able to receive help. Women's insurance status, again, this becomes a little more difficult because some of these mothers are not U.S. citizens and their immigration status is questionable. And so they did the best they could with the mothers that they could help. And as you can see, 28% had it at admission and 42 had a discharge. And again, these are small numbers. There was only 20 moms. WIC, there was less WIC documentation for the moms, unfortunately. So I don't know if these moms were receiving benefits, although they were breastfeeding. You know, they can receive peanut butter, cheese, milk, those types of things. So I don't know. It's hard to tell if the moms were actually receiving WIC. So the strengths of the maternal child health visitation program during this time period was definitely I found the sleeping environment interventions. And the nurses, I don't even think, realized that they were intervening that much on something on that topic. The pediatrician immunization clinic access, also during this time period, and I'm acutely aware of this since I work for the School of Medicine and spend most of my time at UMC, the lead clinic closed during this time, and NICU babies are referred to mostly the lead clinic unless they have another identified pediatrician. So some of the maternal child health nurses had to find new clinics for some of these infants to go. They also encouraged to continue breastfeeding, and they were given lots of handouts. The weaknesses for the program was there was no standard documentation, and at the time of this assessment, there was really no outcomes. It was not goal-driven outcomes. It was sort of they did what they saw necessary, and so there was no clear documentation for some of the outcome measures that we were measuring. Like, there was no dates for the immunizations or PMD visits. Sometimes I would just have to extract data from a subjective note that they had. There was no objective sort of, so in medicine we do subjective data, objective data, and an assessment and a plan, and most of it was subjective, and the objective data had to be taken out of that information. There was also sometimes no follow-up data on immunizations, and the demographic sheets were lacking in their documentation of race, marital status, WIC numbers, Medicaid numbers, so sometimes it was hard to tell. I couldn't use, there was a sheet, I don't have an example of it, but there is one of the screens that they had to fill out, there was an area where you could fill out Medicaid status or something like that, and I couldn't rely on that to tell me if the patient had had Medicaid or not. And inappropriate referrals, which I said that we would come back to, the NICU at UMC was referring every infant to the maternal child health visitation program without any sort of screening. And that was a huge burden on the maternal child health nurses. It meant, I think, 2 or 3 phone calls to each family. And you saw how many that was, 400 or something like that. 400 phone calls, you're talking 1,000 phone calls to families to pick out 150 who would actually enter the program. That referral system was then changed in the summer time, and they went and met with UMC and gave them more stringent referral guidelines of what types of infants would benefit from the program, so that UMC, it left some of the burden on UMC to actually screen their patients. So the questions that came up would, I know that some of the issue is a funding issue for the program, and so we're trying to see what benefit the program had on the community. So should the program continue with the same outcome measures? Should we be looking at immunization status? Should we be looking at newborn screens? Should we be looking at primary care visits, insurance, WIC? Maybe, but I think it needs to be more clearly defined. Should the program continue with the same target population? And actually, I think that there is a different populations that could actually be better served than the NICU population at UMC. The NICU at UMC is very good. I have lots of patients in the NICU at UMC, are very good at making sure that they have primary care providers, making sure that they have sleeping environment education, making sure that they know about immunizations, making sure they even have their immunizations before they leave. So even though those patients are at risk, I think that they are actually at less risk than the drop-ins in the healthy newborn nursery. We have lots of infants that are born at the UMC that are, mothers are drop-ins, had no prenatal care. And while those infants are healthy, we also don't know if the mom has access to care afterwards, how well she is plugged into the systems, how, you know, applying for Medicaid, things like that. So that's where I said we need to determine high-risk populations in the community and probably apply for grant funding for evidence interventions for those populations. I'm sure that there might be some evidence-based medicine or national funding that we could look to for our huge drop-in population because we have a huge immigration, you know, immigrant population, and really look at those infants and how we can affect their outcomes. And that's all I have.
I'm not even going to say board. I'm going to say Chris.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. I think you got some great recommendations that really make it's a worthwhile program, but we really should be targeting the folks that we're looking at. And so not having a, what did you say, not having a standardized screening tool, all those factors. So is part of what you're recommending we have to make that recommendation, or is that something the maternal health group will do on their own?
Maybe I can address that quickly is that obviously, the staff in the maternal child health program have been working with a very challenging population,
absolutely,
to say the least. But at the same time, while all this has been going on and recognizing the challenges that we had in the budget for last year, Bonnie, Margarita, and the staff in MCH have been successful in receiving a new grant for the Healthy Start program to the tune of about $735,000 a year. That particular grant, and as Bonnie reported to you at last month's meeting, covers essentially the same population of people. So that there's
NICU
been a
NICU population or the ones that we aren't really, that are underserved that we really need
it's
to
the It's African-American women, actually, in certain zip codes, and Margarita can speak more to that. Uh-huh.
And the point of that is that This new grant has given us a tremendous opportunity to work in a grant-funded program and in an evidence-based program, mm-hmm, with this population.
I remember the contention that we had, and the board felt very strongly that we continue with the maternal child health. I appreciate
And we are continuing.
And I appreciate the assessment, and just wait 1 second, then maybe you might have more questions to be able to answer with me. I just want to make sure there's a need, and no matter what, the NICU population is very important, but there's also those undocumented moms, and they're here, so we need to deal with that part of it. So as you speak to your grant, tell me or tell us why it was only focused on
The target population is African-American women because they have a huge infant mortality rate, even in Las Vegas, and that is a population that actually made us eligible for the grant. So that is our target population. And it's not just pregnant women. It's pregnant women, and they can enroll as late in pregnancy as we find as they get referred, as well as women that have already had children. And we will serve women with children through the age of 2 years old, and that's by the grant. So we will enroll women with children through the age of one so that we have a good year to work with that family. We are targeting 16 different zip codes within the county, so it's even broader than NFP. It includes the NFP population, and NFP is going to be a very, very much a sister program to this particular program as well, because if there's someone that is referred to Healthy Start that is also eligible for NFP, they're going to go into the evidence-based NFP. While the target population is the African-American population, we can serve other individuals in those zip codes. But really, we were told, and this was by the grantor, that it needs to be, the target needs to be the African-American population, because they are what made us eligible for the program. NFP doesn't have that stipulation. Okay. I mean, we serve anybody and everybody, and about 65% of the women that we serve in NFP are Hispanic.
Well, 89104 is actually where I live. That's my zip code, and I could tell you very much so. 89110, 89115 are all part of my district. So,
and those are all in both service there for both programs, correct. So, you know, we will also serve children that are already born. So if there is someone that the NICU feels needs to be referred, the referral will come in through NFP. We still have some children that we serve that maybe don't necessarily fit into the criteria for both of these. So, for example, we still have to provide nursing case management of children with elevated blood lead levels, and we serve children through the age of 72 months for that. So, and I do have right now staff that does that. So we are with both programs. We are with both of these programs, Healthy Start and NFP, still serving the maternal and child health population.
I think the two-year-old piece county. Will be very key because you do actually see the evolution of what happens, and that's
and it's different from MCH. And one of the problems with MCH is you know they would lose so many families would decide they didn't want the program anymore. What we ask for with both Healthy Start and NFP is a commitment from the family to stay with the program until their child turns two. There's a lot of needs, and we serve really high-risk families. Healthy Start will actually be classifying a risk to determine the number of home visits that they will make or the number of contacts that they will make with each family per month because the caseload that they have to service is so large per case manager. So it's a lot of needs. A lot of needs. We will
Thank
be
you.
Serving this.
I have some additional questions. How many are bilingual?
I just want to back that up. I could tell from just doing data collection that it took about 6-7 home visits to really accomplish the goals. So this is not an easy task, and it has to be done with a lot of follow-up and things. I could just tell that just from looking at the data and what things were accomplished and what time frames. So.
And so many families and or nurses tried to provide as much information sometimes as they could in that initial home visit, which is maybe not optimal because the families are already stressed. So what they retain is not very good, even though they're given written materials. They may not ever get to those written materials again because of what they're dealing with currently. But the reason they did that was because they were not sure that they would ever be able to see that family again, you know, the attrition rate on that.
How many of our nurses are bilingual?
In NFP, I currently have 3.
Out of how many?
Out of 6, so it's half.
Okay, and then how many, because you're still going to overlap zip codes and
we area. Still are. Unfortunately, for Healthy Start at this point, we don't have anybody that is bilingual. So we will have to, you know, kind of screen out for language. As we move forward, that may change.
What do you mean screen out for language? If they
cannot speak English through Healthy Start, we would not be able to serve them at this point. The reason being that there is, we are using a...
Perhaps we can reach out to some community groups that could assist. That's bothersome to me.
We will. There are other agencies in town that might serve that population. Early Head Start is one. So some of those folks that perhaps do not qualify for Healthy Start might be eligible. If they're not eligible for NFP, that could serve them. You know, we would be referring to some of the other community programs. As we move forward, that may change. But as of now, this is what it is.
I think partnering rather than screening a family out that qualifies for every other factor is just kind of bothersome to me.
We also are partnering with Positively Kids.
I was just going to, that was my next
question. They are providing an enrollment specialist for us. That individual is bilingual. So yes, we don't just say no services. We try to refer, and that's why NFP used to refer to MCH because they would refer the women that were not eligible into our MCH program. So it's not like you just drop the hot potato.
Thank you. And Positively Kids was going to be my next question because I didn't see them on your stats for referral. Are they buried in there someplace or do they not necessarily?
Actually, it was the other way around. Maternal and Child Health would refer to Positively Kids. Right.
Okay. And then thank you very much. DFS, when you have your CPS calls, do they then coordinate with the DFS caseworker that's assigned?
They did, yes. They coordinate, and so those actually required more time and effort because every time the nurse would go to the home, they would then call the caseworker. Part of what I thought, sometimes when the CPS case closed, though, the maternal child health nurse would then also close the case.
That's not always, they're not always looking at the same.
Right. Correct. Right.
Okay. And we still have the CPS nurse liaison that actually works with, I believe it's now the 4 and under team. And so she works with that team and visits those children in doctor's offices in the home with the CPS caseworker while that case is open. These are children that are medically fragile or children that have parents that have severe psychiatric or emotional problems, so much so that the caseworker is concerned about the safety of the child. Okay. So we do have a nurse that works very closely with that team. Oftentimes, the referrals that came in from CPS, and I think that continue to come in from CPS, are because the caseworker is intending to close or has closed
right.
the case. And so, you know, our nurse then follows up for a little bit after that. Do want to say that participation in Healthy Start and NFP will be voluntary. Because if you force someone to do something, the changes that you are going to get in that individual are going to be minimal. You know, you're out of there, and they fall back on what they have done previously. A lot of the referrals that we get currently from CPS are on infants that were substance exposed or potentially substance exposed at birth. Again, these folks may be Healthy Start eligible. You know, again, the parent has to want to participate because we're not going to be able to bring about any change if that parent does not want to participate and they're being forced to participate.
Right.
But there's a lot that we can do with Healthy Start for these families.
Thank you. Are your materials bilingual in Spanish, Tagalog, et cetera, et cetera? If not, I have organizations that would be happy to translate them
for you. For NFP, most of the people in the county that speak the Tagalog also speak English, so that's not an issue. And with NFP, what we've come to find out is that a lot of the women that we enroll, the young ladies, speak and understand English, but their support system, perhaps their mother, their spouse, their aunt, their uncle, their grandmother, does not. So that's when we send out a bilingual nurse. NFP does have information in both English and Spanish. The parenting curriculum that we have selected, and it's an expert-recommended curriculum, does have materials in both English and Spanish as well.
Okay, because those zip codes have a lot of Filipino population as well. So
And for NFP, it's a very small percentage that is actually Asian, but they speak English. The individuals that we have enrolled speak English.
We also have a large Ethiopian population over in 89104 as well. So,
we have had some meetings with Spring Valley Hospital for another program that we do, and they serve a lot of the refugee population. And in discussing languages for the materials that we will be using in that particular hospital, they said most of the refugees that they serve also serve English. So they did not see a need to translate the materials that we are using to any language other than English and
Spanish. Being able to speak and understand are two different things, though. And so I would hope that people understand that comprehension is very different from being able just simply to repeat the language. On the ACA insurance, do you refer people to the ACA or assistance out there or to health centers or volunteers in medicine if they don't qualify as
all of the above?
Undocumented? Yeah, they did. They did document that they would try to find places for the mothers to go. And actually, they did document that the ACA, some of the mothers could not afford it. And then they were directed to Southern Nevada Health District or other providers.
We use volunteers in medicine at all?
We do if they're eligible. Most of the for the pregnant women, that's an issue because I don't believe they provide prenatal care at this time. But we would refer, for example, to the UMC Resource Center, the Nevada Obstetrical Charity Clinic, agencies that will provide services at a bit of a discount for women. And I understand that there's a new one in town now that FirstMed is going to be it's a federally qualified health center in town that is going to be providing prenatal care, so that will be another referral source. The problem with our undocumented individuals is that they are not eligible for any of the subsidy that the government provides. So they can buy the insurance, but they have to pay for it full, and many cannot for them. That's an issue. But our nurses, both all of them, all of my maternal child health, all my community health nursing team works to refer families where they might be able to obtain care.
And then for some reason I wrote down a note to myself, and this is more to the doctor. On our immunization component, do you know if we as the county require that our adoptive parents make sure that they go through all the immunizations as part of their arrangements? And if not, maybe we should look into that. I'll look into that as well. But
You like foster kids? I can tell you that they are supposed to be documenting that, because on the foster child medical intake that you do when you see a foster child, you are supposed to indicate if the immunization status and whether they received immunizations that day.
I'll follow up on that. It's just a thought that popped into my head to make sure that we close whatever loopholes we possibly can. Thank you.
You okay?
Years ago, I used to work at Child Haven, and we, of course, referred kids to foster care. And if anything, we found out that children were over-immunized because they would lose records, and so they would require them to immunize them again. And but I did have one question with respect to that, because we did have a medically fragile cottage where we took care of a lot of these babies, and I don't know if that service is still provided at Child Haven. Do you know? I mean, I've been retired like 13 years.
So. I don't think it is because
of
their licensing. I think they had to become more of a daycare or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Versus
that's
a residential. So I think they're trying to. They will house families, you know, on a quote temporary basis if someone comes in an emergency. But I think they're trying to get children out into some.
They're put into foster care. Families now for medically fragile children. Mm-hmm. I deal with a lot of medically fragile children, obviously being a subspecialist, so yeah, they're tried to put into foster homes that can deal with that.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Woods?
Okay, help me out, and I'm an alternate here filling in, so help me out so that I understand this. Now, what I got out of the presentation today was that the maternal child health home visitation program had a grant for last year.
Not a grant. Funded by the
property taxes.
Right.
Oh, okay. So, but it had funding. It does not have funding for this year. Is that correct? That's why the nurses are being transferred to the other departments?
That's what is open for discussion, I think.
Ah, okay. So that's supposed to be.
I still have staff that are funded in there. And actually, that's CPS nurses on contract, but we consider part of the team. But I still have staff on that funding. Some staff, you know, were given the chose to move into some of the other programs because there were evidence-based.
If I can help, there was a board discussion last year where because the program is not evidence-based and most of the other programs in this area are, the board had an extensive discussion about keeping or ending this program, and I think you were brought in to analyze the program with some data, and that's what this presentation is.
Okay.
It was a follow-up to that.
Following here, okay. So now the question is, you've given the questions for future, but is there a recommendation whether after, you know, looking at all this data, are you recommending that this program continue, or are you recommending that because it seems to be other programs doing similar?
Right. So my recommendation, actually, I'm glad that the accreditation talk was right before mine, because I think that that does go under community health assessment for them to determine what the high-risk population is, and if there is grant funding for that. I think that there is always going to be those patients who don't fit into a category or are eligible for a grant-funded evidence-based program, and so I think that we do have to have a provision for that. But it was at one time 5 nurses, and maybe we can pare it down.
And that's exactly what has happened, and I think that was part of Bonnie's report at mm-hmm. our last board meeting, and she reviewed how that has progressed and where we're at.
I'm sorry, I was in Thailand.
Okay.
Could I ask you to send an email to the board members with the zip codes of the new grant? Okay. If you
We can send the email as well as what NFP covers if you'd like for both
programs.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
We'll send them for both.
Okay, thank you.
And I did want to mention that the benchmarks that we looked at, the staff did not start. They had no instruction. They were not measuring anything prior to August of 2015. They had other goals that they perhaps, you know, not that broad, that they looked at. For example, compliance with medical follow-up or medical case plan. That was one of the things that they looked at. And they had sub-assessment sheets where some of these items were marked. So maybe not as broad, but they did do some things prior to that.
Yes, sir.
As I mentioned a while ago, I've had a lot of experience with the MCH program in my private practice in New Mexico. And without giving any background, any repeat, I'd like to suggest to make sure that as part of your accreditation projects, you do this particular division be evaluated and analyzed, because I get a sense in this county that we have a huge unmet need. I don't know that as fact.
Agreed.
30 years ago, we had the same sense in New Mexico, and we did a gap analysis, and we found out that we had an enormous unmet need, and we restructured what we did from the private sector and the public sector. And I would strongly suggest, and I strongly suggest that that be evaluated. There are areas of this county that this particular types of programs aren't beginning to touch. For a number of reasons, but where there might be a huge need. And so before you focus on one particular product or another, I strongly suggest that you do a gap analysis.
Got it. Any other questions from the board? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation and your work. At this time, before we move on to the board reports, let's take a 5-minute recess and reconvene at 10:30.
Before you do that, I apologize. On the consent agenda, we had a petition.
Yes.
The language missing in the non-discrimination, again, is still gender orientation is missing. So if we could have the legal staff update the language and make sure that all contracts have that correctly, I would appreciate it. Yeah, you're missing gender orientation. You don't have the new language from 4 years ago. You have sexual orientation. You do not have the gender identity language in there, in the non-discrim.
You're talking about in the petition?
In the petition 0415.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that was changed.
We've also worked with Tim had given us a follow-up on what they've learned as they've done surveys within their area, and that's actually where we got the contact for this particular group that we're going to be
they
using.
Being whom
they
Tim's Tim who
right
MGM are you saying or what
I'm sorry
I think that was an MGM resource contact
correct
okay.
correct sorry
and
about that.
That's okay. Does it go to Labor and Management Committee at all for them to review? I'd like to see
it
a
will.
Copy of whatever
sure.
that is.
Okay, sure.
We did one when I first got on this board, so
sure.
I probably still have it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that the CHO update?
That's it.
Building update?
For the building update, we have selected a contractor. We've gone through the vetting process. We are finishing the contract language. It's being done so that we can announce, actually next week is when we're going to announce a contractor for the building. We're on schedule. We're still scheduled to occupy the building by the end of this year.
Prevailing wage, correct. And the Shadow Lane still hasn't blown down.
Yeah, but it's missing a lot of copper.
Yes, it is. That'll help with the demo.
And a budget update.
Sharon?
Good morning. My name is Sharon McCoy Huber. I'm the financial services manager for the health district. And what I am going to begin doing is quarterly give you an update as to the financial status of the health district. I know historically you always receive a monthly financial report, and I'd kind of like to change it, but I'd also like to do a brief presentation quarterly so that that way if you have any questions, we can discuss them. And where I'd like to start is I've done a graph on the general fund expenditures, and the breakout is employee salaries, fringe benefits, and payroll taxes, as well as services and supplies. These numbers are as of December 31st, 2014. The employee salaries are actual is at 45% of our budget. Fringe benefits are at 44% of our budget, and service and supplies are at 44% of the budget. One of the things I'd like to share with you is that these are just general fund dollars. These are the tax dollars and the charges for services, those types of dollars. These do not include any of the grant dollars. Moving forward, and you'll see it next month in the budget presentation for fiscal year 15-16, is we're breaking the grant dollars into special revenue funds and will no longer be maintained in the general fund. So that this way, because your special revenue funds and your grant dollars, the money in and the money out always net out to zero. So it'll delineate exactly where your general fund is versus your grant.
Usually almost zero.
Well, majority of the time. And so with that being said, the general fund revenues, you'll see that we've got the fees for service, the regulatory revenues, and the taxes. In total, our revenues are at 62%, and primarily that's because we receive all of our food establishment permits at the beginning of the fiscal year in July and August. And so our revenues are heavier at the beginning of the year, and then they slow down through the end of the year. Our taxes, we receive the 1/12th every month of what was budgeted, so we're exactly at 50% there. And so if we go on and look at the grant expenditures, it's broken out the same way that the general fund expenditures were broken out, but in total we're at 53% of grant expenditures, where in total for the general fund we were at 46%. So and this is the kind of information that I would like to share with you moving forward also. And the grant revenues, we break them out by sources: the state funding, federal grants, and then the federal funds that are distributed by the state. And so it shows you where most of our grant funds come from, and then where we're at. We're currently at 59% of our revenues, which, as Mr. Beer stated, not always do your revenues equal your expenditures. And in this example, that was because at the beginning of the year and in last year's audit, we had attempted to recognize revenue that wasn't received within the 60-day period that is defined in our policy. And so that revenue is recognized this year, but yet the expenditures were recorded in last year. So that's the big difference there. And then the last graph that I'd like to share with you is fund balance. I know historically, and that was a lot of the research I did prior to accepting the job here at the health district, was the concerns about what's happening to the fund balance here at the health district. If you notice here, we were almost at $30 million in 2010-2011. You can see it dramatically dropped in 11-12, and then in 12-13, it crept back up. The main reason it crept up is because that was the year that we received the back taxes from Clark County that we had taken them to court on. And then in 13-14, our fund balance dropped to about $12.9 million. And then we projected at the end of this budget year that we would be at $6.1 million. Currently, though, we are at $20.4 million. And the main reason that that is like I shared, that our revenues are at 62% and our expenditures are at 45%. We're going to spend a lot more in the next 6 months than we will receive. I do not believe that our fund balance at the end of the year will be the $6 million. I'm projecting that it will come in higher than the $6 million. And that's information I'll be sharing next month, both with the Finance Committee and the Board. On the budget for 15-16, I will be sharing the three-year projection and where I believe we're moving. So with that being said, I'd like to know if there's any questions or any additional information you'd like to see, because it's kind of an evolving, so I'm kind of trying to work with you guys and see what you'd like to see financially.
Thank you. On the county's contribution to the settlement, we actually didn't finish, I think, that court case. But be that as it may,
Part of what we're struggling with is the continual abatements happening legislatively, which impact
Correct.
Our impact on the property taxes.
Correct.
So as your lobby team looks, maybe there could be a better coordination that some of these need to be opposed outright. They're just tax credit. Everything's coming out of funds that affect all of us
yeah.
being able to have the ability to pay.
That's great.
Some of these board members are young and have keen eyesight. I am not one. And so I have trouble reading the screens in the back, particularly. If you could provide paper copy in the future, it would help me out.
I will do that, and also in the future it'll be PowerPoint, so hopefully it'll be bigger too. Definitely you'll get handouts.
Well, if not handouts, at least if you can put it on the iPad so that we can pull it up.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I think it is on your iPad now.
It is.
But it wasn't added until this morning, and I apologize for that. This was kind of a work in progress.
All right. Thank you very much. Any additional questions from the board?
Nope.
Okay.
Thank you.
Legislative agenda presentation? Anybody here to make that, or is everybody up in Carson City?
Everybody. It's in Carson City, and things are just progressing. We don't have anything to update on that.
Okay. So that takes us to the informational items, monthly activity reports. You all had linked electronic copies. And any questions on any of that? Okay. We'll come to agenda item 9, public comment, a period devoted to comments by the general public, if any, and discussion of those comments about matters relevant to this board's jurisdiction will be welcomed. No action may be taken upon a matter raised under this item of this agenda until the matter itself has been specifically included on an agenda as an item upon which action may be taken pursuant to NRS 241.020. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes per speaker. Please step up to the podium, state your name and address.
Thank you.
Spell your last name for the record. If any member of the board wishes to extend the length of a presentation, this can be done by the chairman or by majority vote of the board.
My name is Lorraine Oliver, and most of you know me because I have been before you on many occasions weeping, particularly for the continuance of the maternal child health program. And I'm here, first of all, to say once again, by the 9-12 vote that you gave us to continue for that 1 year, thank you. We appreciated it. The two that didn't go along with it at that point said they would have had we been able to do more NFP nursing. Well, we are now down to a team of half a nurse. And we were crying then because we were four. And I'm not one of the nurses anymore, so I'm now changed my focus. Well, why was I convinced to change? Because it was brought to me about the information on the Healthy Start grant. And you've heard a lot of it from Margarita. Bonnie did a presentation last board meeting for you guys. What you have in front of you is the zip code areas that we will be servicing now. The Healthy Start grant has been in effect since 1991 in some form or manner throughout the United States. I think it started in Florida. And for those of you who might have maybe a little pause or a little question as to why it is that we need to focus on African American women, please let me drive this home for you today. I've been going through various articles, and I feel like I'm not sure if I get more upset or more excited as I read about what is going on within our country, but specifically with African American women. This graph is not difficult to see. You can all see the lines. The tallest blue line on the right is the African American statistic for infant mortality. It is 13.31. Compare that with the white woman having a baby, that woman is 5.63. And I feel like we should be unapologetic.
What is that metric? Is that
this is
per 1,000?
It is per 1,000 live births.
mortality per 1,000 live births?
Correct. And it's by rate. And this one, this whole article goes into the fact that even though this statistic has improved for some people, it has gotten decidedly worse for the African-American women. And then I thought, okay, this is really upsetting me, so I'd love to plow in hand and foot and do everything I can as a maternal child health nurse. And then I started to read about the maternal mortality rate. And I'm just going to read one sentence out of the CDC article because I don't want to be at risk of going past the time. And it says, there remains a tremendous race-based disparity in the risk of maternal death. The pregnancy-related mortality ratio among non-Hispanic white women and non-Hispanic black women were 12 to 38.9, respectively, deaths per live birth. That's one statistic that shocked the pants off of me. And then the other statistic that they listed here, 3 points down, was that minority women with 3 previous live birth children are more likely to die compared to non-Hispanic white women. Minority women are more likely to die from complications related to ectopic pregnancies. We have 22 benchmarks to meet with the Healthy Start grant, and those benchmarks are not only focusing in on this woman during her pregnancy. We are trying to look at her life course. We're going to be going from 18 to 45. We can also admit 15 to 18-year-olds that are pregnant. And we want to, of course, as Margarita said, stay in the home till the children are 2. We want to try and involve the father. Where you folks can help us, and I know you've all noticed that we don't go to Henderson, neither NFP nor I, us will be going to Henderson, is that we are going to be looking to achieve collective impact. If we do this job well, we can have this funding continued. Places like Florida have had this funding continued since 1991. They were even probably at risk of this funding changing recently, and they were able to impress with their numbers at how compelling their work was. We're not going to be able to see everybody based on what we've got now, but please, as members of your cities and stuff, come out, get in touch with Margarita and Barney, and see how it is that we can impact your people the most. In front of you are the list of our zip codes. The zip codes were not created just from the air. This was a NCRIP study, so the evidence-based study says that is where we need to focus our efforts for African-American people that meet our population. 115 was the worst. So 115 is, in fact, one of the ones that we really need to focus in. So you see, if you turn over the page, you can actually see them in number form, and those are the zip codes that we will be focusing in on. I do agree with you, Council Person June Kalyani, that we do need to look at maternal child, that there will still be a gap, and we will still be trying to find ways to make an impact in the community. And as an experienced public health nurse, I can tell you that 80% of our caseloads were Hispanic ladies, and of those, many were undocumented. So that need is not going anywhere, and I agree that we need to do something with that. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you for your presentation.
When they wrote the grant, what census data or statistics were used to drive the zip codes?
Could you come back and you mentioned it a little bit, yeah.
Yes, well, that was a NCRIP study that looked at it, and that's as much as I know. I'm not a lead person in this grant. I'm just going to be one of the grunt staff that goes out there and tries to help mothers. That has been my passion, and I intend to continue that. But it was a NCRIP study that figured out these parameters of the grant that said, and so, you know, sometimes evidence-based doesn't help.
Exactly. And I don't want to lose sight. I know my 104, for example, went from one to the other. I have a large African-American population in that area as well. And 1110 just went to NFP. What was an unfortunate argument or disagreement last time around when the budgets were approved, this board overwhelmingly said we wanted to continue with MCH. I believe personally that some of you were undercut so that you couldn't be as efficient to come back and report to us. But that's just my personal bias.
Well, to address a little bit of the study that was done, the study was done from August till now. So we, in fact, were not collecting the data as much on the mothers as we could have. We also, of course, we never got to meet the doctor to, like, figure out what they wanted, so that we could have a chance to do input. We're just hearing now what it was, and we were told somewhere along the line, now you just have to start collecting this. We started admitting mothers, that's why they looked so few, but we haven't been doing that. All our efforts were focused on babies wherever we got them.
And I think we were able
to go to the whole of the city, all the cities. I think that's going to be, I know the populations I visited in Henderson, and I'm surprised that none of them rose to the NCRIP study level that we would be able to follow.
I'm not looking, thank you, and your passion is wonderful. I'm just making, I believe that there was disagreement between management and the board, and that it wasn't, there was a way to not make MCH be able to prove its point because there had been no direction or data collection or something along, whatever was down those lines. I just think that you don't, there's enough need for everybody in this business, and the board was, you don't want me to say.
Can you address a little bit more of the geographic determination?
Margarita De Santos, I'm sorry, this is before Community Health Nurse Manager. We looked at areas of need that had previously been identified, and it was based on a study that was done by the state, as well as, I think, the old United Way one. That was initially used to identify areas for NFP when we first brought in NFP in 2008, and those have not really changed. We also looked at where was the African-American population as well in those areas of need.
They're very assimilated now. If you didn't use the updated census, then you're missing a whole group of people, in my opinion.
I was before, and I am now still a bit perplexed that we're using someone else's community health assessment to make decisions for this district.
And perhaps once we are complete with our accreditation information, that might shed some new light on that. We are aware of the fact that there are pockets of need everywhere. It's just, you know, what can we do most efficiently with our staff? We are expected to serve 500 individuals, that's mothers and children, through the age of 2 a year at any one point with Healthy Start. That's a huge caseload for our managers. So one of the things that needs to be kept in mind is you want them to have the time to make visits and make contact with those families and not spend huge amounts of time driving. So it's looking at many, many things.
And structured programs like this produce documented outcomes that can be used in the next grant application and expand the geography.
Oh, yeah, I'm not arguing against the Healthy Start. I think it's great. I think it's an augmentation. But I don't appreciate when a board gives direction and then it gets undercut for an entire year so they can justify not having to move forward with it. That's my position.
And I'm just concerned that, and while I completely agree that the African-American population is underserved, like in Mesquite, we have a very, very small African-American population, but we have a huge Hispanic population that is not going to qualify for these programs. That's why I guess our zip code's not on there.
And I do, you know, we do agree as well that Hispanic population is an area of need. But again, looking at what the specifics of the grant were for this particular one, the population that made us eligible was the African-American population because of their very disparate infant mortality rates. And that is the guidance that we received from the grantor. Our Hispanic women may have needs, but they tend to have better birth outcomes, whatever that may be. And there's a lot of study going on that just in terms of racial disparities and what women may have suffered throughout their lifetimes. But this is the grant as it is for now. We are working very hard to make it successful so that we can continue to get funding and possibly even grow. I understand that there are some opportunities coming out to apply for some expansion of evidence-based home visiting programs, and evidence-based is a thing that the federal government tends to want to fund anymore. That may allow us to expand if we apply in the future, for example, NFP. So, questions? That is what made us eligible for it. And when HRSA grants things, they are looking at where can they make the biggest impact. So again, when you are targeting that population that has such huge disparities in birth outcomes and maternal mortality, we can make a greater impact targeting them, not meaning that we're not going to serve any other ethnic or racial group, but by targeting that, we can hopefully make a huge impact with those particular statistics.
Any additional thoughts, board members? Any additional public comment today?
Victoria Harding, Vice President of the General Unit of SEIU. I was originally coming today to talk about MCH. Thank you, everybody, for that. Unfortunately, we've had a lot of incidents unfold in the last week that we feel are very egregious. We feel it's under your purview here as the board, and I have to bring this to somebody's attention so that we can get something done as quickly as possible on this. I'm sorry Dr. Eiser isn't here today to hear it. And from the union standpoint, you know, what we can do if HR isn't taking care of it, if management's not taking care of it, what can we do? We can do petitions, we can do pickets, we can do all these things that I feel are really bad for the district. Just really bad for the district, bringing negative attention on it, when we can just simply solve the problem by having the board hopefully speak with Dr. Eiser to solve the issue. I brought this to the attention during Dr. Eiser's evaluation many, many months ago. This is about the environmental health program. And we had a situation unfolding in the last week, starting with the Restaurant Association meeting. It didn't go very well for Jackie Rezitar, our director. I heard that actually through industry. And she actually took that out on her employees. She went back and she took that out on her employees, and she screamed at the top of her lungs at her employees to the point where they actually walked out on her. They're done. The employees are just done. They cannot take this abuse any longer. And I'm not even blaming Jackie Rezitar, because if you look at Jackie, she came to us supervising five people. Previously, she comes from a military background. Communication is not their thing. She's dealing with an industry that's asking questions. She feels like this is, you know, attack on her because she doesn't know all the answers to the questions. I don't even expect her to know all the answers to all these questions. So, you know, she doesn't have those communication skills. She hasn't had it effectively in the community. She hasn't had it effectively with the employees. HR has been with her now for at least 6 months in all the meetings with her. She, you know, HR, it's not enough for somebody in HR to play both sides and say, yes, we know employees that this is wrong, but she's your director, you have to follow this. And there just has to be something done. And it's not that nobody knows about this, it is. It's, you know, the dirty little secret. And I brought this up many, many months ago. Dr. Eiser is actually under your purview. And I just think somebody needs to talk to him, whether it's collectively, individually, if somebody can reach out to him and say that this actually has to be addressed at this point, because we can't continue any longer. And I don't want to escalate to the point of doing petitions, standing outside and picketing with, we demand to be treated with respect. You know, this isn't appropriate. I'm not excusing what she's done. I don't feel that she's a horrible person. Honestly, I don't even want her disciplined. This isn't about that. It doesn't solve the issue to just suspend somebody or do something. This woman is struggling, and we brought her in knowing the issues that she was going to have in transitioning to Las Vegas with this many people and the population that we serve. We need to give her the support that she deserves, training, whatever it is, somebody coming in and really dealing with the Environmental Health Department and solving the issues. And I know I'm looking at Michael, because Michael, we did this at the union. You know, we had some really deep divides in there. What did we do? We all wanted to come to a solution so that we could function properly. We sat down, we discussed it, and within no time at all, we were functional again. What has happened? Because after this yelling, now at this point, if anyone questions Jackie Rezatar, they will be disciplined. Their supervisors will be disciplined. Maybe even management will be disciplined. This has gone out. This is the response. Not an I'm sorry that I did that, that I'm just under so much frustration and issues. I'm actually going to punish you for what I have done wrong. And we just can't take it anymore. There has to be a resolution to this. So thank you.
Given that Dr. Iser's not here, could we get a transcript or a recording put together? So he gets an opportunity to hear that public comment.
And I'll make sure that the information is passed ahead. I'm not exactly sure what Victoria is talking about. I will be glad to follow up on that immediately.
Chris?
Tim has a question. It was Tim? First.
I would just say that I did attend the industry meeting. I think that industry has good respect for Jackie and the work she does. I didn't perceive of any issue of discontent there. So that said, I find it kind of divergent opinions here. So I'm, as a board member, I'm interested in finding out what's the middle ground here.
And can we include Mr. Jones' comments as well?
We will.
Thank you.
I will follow up with that. I have heard from some in the industry on the opposite side of Mr. Jones, but we tend to be that way from time to time, but also from minority businesses that believe that they're being discriminated against or singled out based on direction that's being given. There is a management issue that needs to be dealt with, and it's been for a year. To bring someone in that doesn't have the expertise of dealing with hundreds of staff, let alone this type of industry, sets that person up for failure. And I think that's what the union is saying. It's not a criticism. It's just a recognition. So if we got a problem, then we need to deal with it and not just dismiss it. So hopefully once you take your verbatims and whatever, I'm happy to intercede if you need me for something, because at some point it's about bringing compromise to folks and finding out their strengths and working with that part of it. But this industry is absolutely key to this Southern Nevada, but to the state. If you don't have EH running right, you're messing up everything else that deals with our clientele and our constituents. So we have an obligation to act on that.
Doug? Yeah, and as you know, we were in a meeting yesterday with some of the solid waste people. They walked away with the same impression about Jackie, that they were very disappointed in her responses and the way the meeting had gone. I was going to talk to you privately afterwards, but I would still like to.
Okay. We don't want to certainly be perceived as giving direction or taking action. Since this is not an agendized topic, I don't believe that's what I just heard. And with that, we are adjourned.
You need to make a note that the next meeting is an evening meeting. Everybody's aware of that, I would assume.